This is Encounter on VOA. Here's Carol Castillo.
Welcome to Encounter on the Voice of America. On this edition of the program, while the impeachment trial of U.S. President Donald Trump grabs domestic and international headlines, he touts his economic record at the 50th World Economic Forum in Davos. Hello again, I'm Carol Castiel. At this annual Global Economic Forum, President Trump boasted about what he called America's extraordinary prosperity on his watch, taking credit for a soaring stock market, a low unemployment rate, and a so-called blue-collar boom in jobs and income. However, he also renewed his threat to put hefty tariffs on European cars, promising hardball tactics if trade negotiations do not go his way. Before he headed to Davos, President Trump oversaw the signing of a Phase One trade agreement with China, which is an important achievement. The deal stopped the imposition of new U.S. tariffs on China in return for Chinese purchases of more U.S. agricultural products and some new protection of American firms' intellectual property, among other things. Yet, the deal hardly closes the book on trade tensions. China has never actually committed publicly to the levels of agricultural purchases that U.S. officials have advertised. Many tariffs remain in place on both sides, and, most important, the deal doesn't really dismantle the structural elements of China's centrally controlled economy that U.S. officials say provide Beijing its biggest and most unfair trading advantages. Since these tariffs began, Americans have paid roughly $43 billion in new taxes. Moreover, American farmers have lost market share due to Chinese retaliation. So the trade war is not yet over. Analysts say the second phase will be harder than the first. In addition, the U.S. Senate overwhelmingly approved a sweeping U.S. economic pact with Canada and Mexico, the so-called USMCA, delivering on President Trump's promise of a new North American trade deal. The House of Representatives had previously approved the revised agreement by a wide margin after months of negotiations between Democrats and the White House produced pro-labor revisions. Well, for an update on the Trump administration's controversial approach to international trade and economic policy, we talk with two distinguished international trade experts. Ambassador Rufus Yerxa is president of the National Foreign Trade Council. That's a preeminent Washington-based business association dedicated to fostering an open, rules-based world economy. Among his many previous roles, Ambassador Yerxa served as Deputy Director of the World Trade Organization. He also served as Deputy U.S. Trade Representative under both Republican and Democratic presidents. And William Reinch, he's Senior Advisor specializing in trade at the Center for Strategic and International Studies. William Reinch previously served as the Undersecretary of Commerce for Export Administration during the Bill Clinton administration. And both distinguished gentlemen join me here at the VOA Broadcast Center in Washington. Welcome to the program.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
So, William Reinch, you were here at these mics about a year and a half ago. Now, in Davos, President Trump touted what he described as a blue-collar boom, transforming the American economy, hailing the U.S. trade agreement with China in this speech to global business and government leaders. What's your broad take on the America First, this rather protectionist approach to trade policy, using tariffs against both friends and foes? What's your take on this so far?
Well, I think the president will say every deal he negotiates is the greatest ever, and we're seeing that now. I think the evidence is beginning to stack up to suggest that tariff threats, which is what he's prone to do, does get people to the table. It's hard to argue that. I don't think it produces the sweeping landmark great agreements that he talks about. The agreements that he's negotiated, for the most part, have been incremental improvements, a collection of low-hanging fruit, in the China case in particular, the things the Chinese were prepared to give, with the more difficult issues postponed until later. So I would not foresee a huge economic impact. In the case of the USMCA agreement that you mentioned with Canada and Mexico, the International Trade Commission did an analysis of that last spring when the agreement came out, and they concluded that it had a very small favorable impact on the economy. So, and that's a good statement about all of them. They're not negative. They don't hurt necessarily. There's some good things in them. way less than the president says.
How do you see it, Rufus? You're so much less than what the president says that, okay, tariffs bring people to the table, but they don't produce any sweeping landmark agreements as he purports.
I generally agree with what Bill has said about them. I mean, I think it's hard to argue that it wasn't important for the administration to challenge a lot of Chinese policies and practices. I think not just the U.S., but a lot of countries have problems with the way China's run its economy, this sort of mixed economy of state intervention and the private sector in a way that really hasn't delivered a lot of the benefits we thought we were going to get from China when China came into the WTO, for example. But that being said, certainly the business groups I represent have enormous concerns about how much disruption and uncertainty this approach has caused, because it not only led to a lot of tariffs on products that U.S. manufacturers use, it also, as you know, led to Chinese retaliation, which wiped out a lot of our agricultural exports and other growing exports we had to China. The other problem is, of course, he not only started a big tariff fight with China, but he imposed, for example, tariffs on steel and aluminum from countries around the world. Those countries retaliated. So we are not only in a fight with China, but in a fight with some of our best allies and supporters who we really need to have on our side if we're going to push China in the right direction. What business would like to see is more focus on a rules-based approach rather than what we fear is happening, which is a more kind of mercantile market-sharing approach. If you look at this deal with China, there's all kinds of things in there that reflect more a kind of planned economy approach to trade with each other. Will you commit to sell us this many billions of dollars worth of farm goods and industrial goods? And there's less of the real structural reform in China on its subsidy practices and other things. There are some things in the agreement, but clearly, that's not as good as we would like on the rules side, and it's worse than business wants to see in terms of the kinds of disruptions and uncertainty it's creating. And if you look at the details of this deal, there may be even more uncertainty, even though the deal is signed, because the U.S. can kind of unilaterally judge whether China's performing well and may reintroduce tariffs in the future. For the time being, we've got some ceasefire in increasing a tariffs. We still have a lot of tariffs in place, by the way, over $350 billion worth of imports that are subject to new tariffs.
Well, let's dig a little deeper into that phase one of the economic and trade agreement with China. So back to you, William Reinsch. Many businesses say that it offers little relief for them because so many tariffs are still in place. How does it affect our farmers and manufacturers and their ability to plan and so forth?
Well, I think the farmers are going to be winners, maybe not as much as they expect, but the purchase commitments the Chinese have made with respect to agriculture are significant, probably soybeans and corn and some other things. In addition, there's a lot of interesting language that has been overlooked, I think, by some people in the agreement on agriculture, where the Chinese made a number of, I would say, genuinely trade liberalizing commitments, where they agreed to accept international standards or agreed to accept our standards of health safety for various products. And they're not big products, you know, blueberries, avocados, barley, and, you know, we're not going to bury China in blueberries in the next 6 months. But the fact that they are willing to accept international standards or our standards, and I think probably we'll end up doing that on a most favored nation basis, so everybody will benefit, that's a good sign. It's not a big sign, but it also suggests that over time we may be able to grow our exports there. The new unknown that I think people are going to be thinking about is whether or not any of these deals will be consummated to the extent that is promised. And there's a couple issues. A lot of the debate has been, is China really going to buy all that stuff? I think the more important question is, are we really going to sell all that stuff? First of all, do we have the capacity to make or grow everything that they promised to buy? There's still only one soybean crop a year. Mother Nature hasn't changed the rules. So even if we sell them every last soybean, is that going to be enough? Second, I think our farmers are smart, and they're going to be reluctant to put all their beans in one basket, as it were. You don't want to have your only customer be a country that has a long history of turning its purchases on and off for political reasons, because then you end up dependent on them, and they can, on a whim, close things off. So I think what you're going to find is some farmers saying, we're not going to sell everything to China. We want to retain our other customers. We want to have some diversity. So it wouldn't surprise me if next October, when people start adding all this stuff up, you may find a situation that's not what we expect. That is, the Chinese are going around trying to buy, and they're going to have trouble finding Americans who want to sell.
Well, back to you, Rufus Yerxa, to get your extended view on this phase one of the deal. Do you think that it offsets the damaging trade war that President Trump, in a sense, ignited with China, especially since, as you all said, most of the tariffs on Chinese exports will remain in place?
Yeah, there are two big problems. One is, how much will China actually deliver on meaningful commitments? I agree with Bill. There are some things in here which, if they were to follow through on, might be big improvements. Let's remember, you know, American agriculture was actually doing quite well in exports to China before the trade war started. We had $26 billion worth of agriculture exports. I don't know how long it's actually going to take for farmers to get back to where they were. And I fully agree with everything he said about the way this agreement was put together. It's really a managed trade deal which gives the Chinese government power to turn on and off exports much more easily, ironically, because U.S. farmers had developed a lot of private buyers in China, but now the government is going to be the one sort of controlling the import licenses. It's ironic that in trying to change China's state trading sort of mentality, we've actually reinforced the strength of the state in controlling their own economy. That might be to Xi Jinping's liking, actually, but it's not really going to help sort of the private sector in China as much. The more important stuff in the agreement would have been the things that have to do with investment in China and restrictions on intellectual property and other things that could encourage foreign companies to be able to operate more freely in the Chinese market. And so far, the agreement, it sort of codifies a lot of the things China was already doing in many of these areas, in investment laws and IP, intellectual property and others. So we'll have to see how this evolves. I don't think we're going to see the kind of explosion in exports to China that the administration is portraying. And in the meantime, we're still dealing with the drag of tariffs, not only in the U.S. market. Remember, China has not committed to eliminate its retaliatory tariffs. And the other big problem, of course, is we're now moving to some trade fights with others.
Europe.
And I think you're getting to Europe. And the real question is, do you want to be fighting this trade war on several fronts? Because U.S.-European relations are worsening, partly because of things the administration has set in motion, like threats to impose tariffs on autos. And that's going to become a bigger and bigger issue in 2020.
You're listening to Encounter on The Voice of America. My guests are Ambassador Rufus Yerxa, from whom you just heard. He's president of the National Foreign Trade Council. That's a Washington-based business association. And William Reinsch, senior advisor specializing in trade at the Center for Strategic and International Studies. And in the wake of the Davos conference, we're assessing and discussing the impact of Trump administration trade policies. This is a reminder that our Encounter podcast is available for free download on our website at voanews.com/encounter. You may also follow us on Twitter or connect with us on Facebook at Carol Castiel, VOA. Here's a big shout out to Derek Osei-Yeboa. He's a loyal fan from Accra, Ghana. If you want to hear your name and home country on the air, please send an email to encounter@voanews.com or like us and leave a comment on our Facebook page. So back to you, William Reinsch. I want to pick up on something Rufus said before we went to break about our allies and how President Trump at Davos was already threatening tariffs on European autos if things don't go his way. But we need allies, don't we, still, to combat China's unfair trading practices. And my question is, had the United States stayed in the Trans-Pacific Partnership, would that have been maybe better or equally good an approach to combating China's trade practices as this approach President Trump has opted for, imposing tariffs and doing things unilaterally? I'm just curious how you see that.
Oh, no question about it. I think, and people are beginning to realize that now. The point of TPP, the Trans-Pacific Partnership, was not just about trade. It was to cement the U.S. presence in the Pacific diplomatically and strategically, but it was also to create a large rules-based consumer market where countries protected intellectual property, countries honored each other's obligations, countries had rule of law structures and had dispute settlement processes that were fair, objective, and transparent and timely, none of which really is talking about China. But the idea was that if you create that big group and it grows, eventually the Chinese would come in, because the consequence of not coming in, it would be that their companies would move to countries that were in, because they want to take advantage of the tariff-free status of being inside the zone. So the Chinese would come in, and the idea was would have to adhere to the rules. Maybe they would, maybe they wouldn't, but it certainly would take us a lot farther in that direction than what we've got now, because what the administration did is pull out and then replace it with nothing. They talked about bilateral agreements, but aside from Korea, where we already had one, and a small one with Japan, they haven't moved forward with other bilaterals in Asia.
I think it is useful to look at how things could have been, Rufus, if the United States had stayed in the TPP. But we know that President Trump is allergic to anything President Obama did and promoted, and he, of course, helped to move that forward. And we know that President Trump does not like multilateral agreements, trade agreements. So he decided, well, we're going to do it our own way. But had we stayed in, do you think also that we could have been in a different place than we are now vis-a-vis combating China's unfair trading practices?
Yeah, I think probably fundamentally that was a major strategic error driven maybe by the politics of trade more than anything. The 2016 election reflecting a lot of voter dissatisfaction with prior trade deals. So Trump came in, he said he was pulling out of TPP, which hadn't yet been adopted by the U.S. Congress. To our surprise, the TPP countries went forward with the deal anyway without us. And what that agreement really held the promise of with respect to China is creating a lot of rules in the Asia-Pacific sphere that China would have had to prepare to cope with among many of its major trading partners, Japan, Vietnam, some of the ASEAN countries. And so when he decided not to do that and instead focused really the first year of the presidency on a renegotiation of NAFTA, which resulted, of course, in this USMCA agreement that just got finished, I would describe the USMCA agreement as the old NAFTA with some of the add-ons that came from the TPP agreement, ironically. They took a lot of the new provisions of TPP and put them into this new USMCA. Other than that, 90% of the deal is the same deal as the original NAFTA. So why they wasted a year and a half doing that instead of just joining TPP, which, by the way, Canada and Mexico are both members of and signatories to, we could have gotten all of the things we got in USMCA, not just with Canada and Mexico, but with the rest of the Asian TPP members. The real issue is going to be, do people trust the U.S. now, having been the leader in negotiating the TPP and then after a change in presidents pulling out? There are issues of trust in countries negotiating further with us, which I think is going to be a big problem for the Trump administration if they're in a second term.
William Reinsch, Rufus Yerxa makes a very good point about this question of trust, because the United States under Mr. Trump has imposed tariffs on its friends and allies, and there's this sense of a lack of trust. So with respect to USMCA, this new NAFTA 2, or however one wants to characterize it, do you agree that, ironically, that had the United States stayed in the TPP, that perhaps we would not have had to renegotiate NAFTA because Mexico is a member of the TPP?
First, on the trust issue, that's a very well taken point. And the classic example of that is what Trump at one point was going to do to Mexico. He signs the USMCA agreement on December 1st, 2018. 6 months later, almost to the day, he's threatening across-the-board tariffs on Mexico because he's unhappy with their immigration policy. Now, if you're another country looking at this, you've got to think, what is the point of negotiating with the United States? If you can reach an agreement, and in less than a year, the American president is prepared to throw it all in the trash can for some other unrelated reason, what's the point? And I think we have a serious credibility problem with our allies. On the USMCA versus TPP issue, I would argue that I think the USMCA was still necessary. Mm-hmm. The point of NAFTA, going back to 1994, was to build an integrated North American market. It was not about Asia. It was about an integrated North American market, and it took significant strides in that direction. 25 years later, it's badly out of date. You know, there was no e-commerce chapter, no digital trade chapter, out-of-date IP protection chapters. It needed an upgrade, and I think TPP would have provided that upgrade. That's a fair point. But I still think having the regional trilateral agreement on top of that or underneath it is still a good thing.
By the way, I'm not suggesting that I'm unhappy that USMCA was concluded, because I think Bill is right. I give the administration high marks for getting it done. I think the episode Bill referred to when the president tried to use an unrelated statute to raise tariffs across the board on Mexico for immigration policy, notwithstanding the commitment he just made in USMCA, the interesting thing was there was an overwhelmingly negative reaction to his effort to do that, even by Republicans in the Congress, by the market, by the business community. And I think he's probably not going to threaten that again. I think now he's turned his attention to Europe, and that's why I'm worried about the European relationship.
Let me end on this note and to kind of go back to the beginning and talking about how President Trump is taking credit for what he considers an excellent economy, especially as measured by the stock market. We have low unemployment. That's another good indice. But back to you, William Reinsch. The stock market isn't really the economy. Maybe it used to be a good barometer, but is that still the case?
You know, if you own stock, a soaring stock market is a good thing. I don't know the current percentage, but I think at least half the country doesn't own any stock.
Right.
And so what happens in the stock market is sort of irrelevant to them unless there's a huge crash, and then there's a whole bunch of ripple effects that are devastating.
Right, but he says that he's creating a blue-collar boom. Is that rhetoric, or is there...
There's not a lot of evidence of that. Even if you look at the steel industry, for example, which has been a favorite of his, in the extreme short term, there was a facility or two, a factory or two reopened and some people hired. I think subsequently new layoffs have exceeded hiring since the tariffs went into place. It's hard to say that it's a blue-collar boom. I mean, the fact is the United States economy is more than 75% services, not manufacturing, and that's growing. Our economy has changed over the years. When I give speeches about this, I end up saying, you know, Trump's lost in the 50s. He wants to take us back to a time when steel and cars and coal were a big deal, and times have changed. I think in terms of the blue-collar workforce, I think probably the debate in the election, once the Democrats stop debating themselves and start debating him, is going to focus on inequality and the growing gap between the rich, who are doing very, very well and getting a much bigger piece of the pie, and the not-so-rich and even the middle class that is at best marking time, which is not a new development. If you look at median household income, for example, the level that we achieved in 1999 was not reached again until 2017. Subsequently, it's ticked up a little bit, but the gap between the top and very large middle and bottom is getting bigger.
And so you get the last word, Rufus Yerxa, to talk about how President Trump says that he's transforming the economy. There's a blue-collar boom. He measures the strength of the economy through the soaring stock market. But what's the real deal?
Well, look, I'm very hopeful that we're going to have a good economy for years to come, but that's by no means certain. And if you look at our growth rate right now, you know, it's down around 2%, something like that. It's not much higher than it was in the Obama administration. Unemployment is very low, and that's a good thing. Bill's right. You know, for the first time, real income of wage earners has started to tick up. And that's largely because we have a very, very tight labor market. That's both good and bad. You know, big problem for a lot of businesses right now is finding people to fill the skilled labor that they need. And the other thing is the economy has changed dramatically since the 1980s. We're producing a lot more with fewer people. And so what we need in order for our manufacturing sector to expand is we need to be able to sell to the 95% of the world's consumers that live outside the United States. You can't do that without having good trade relations and without investing a lot of time and effort in building a system of trade rules that commits these countries to keep their markets open. One of the big problems I have with what we're doing now is for 70 years, we've preached to the rest of the world about rules, about sticking to their commitments, about respecting international agreements. And if we're not doing that, if we're moving instead to a world of kind of mercantile one-off deals among countries, I'm very worried that Americans are going to see, you know, we're now exporting $2.5 trillion in goods and services. You know, we've got a $20 trillion economy, so trade isn't the biggest part of it, but it's really important to our long-term future. And Americans benefit enormously from the lower costs that global trade delivers. Americans are not just producers, they're consumers. And as Bill said, 75% of them are working in the services sector. The fastest growing part of the services sector are things like digital services, where our global opportunities are huge if we don't mess up the world economy.
Well, on that note, I'm afraid that's all the time we have on this edition of Encounter. I'd like to thank my guests, Ambassador Rufus Yerxa, he's president of the National Foreign Trade Council, and William Reinch, senior advisor specializing in trade at the Center for Strategic and International Studies. Gentlemen, thank you for a terrific conversation.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Encounter was produced in Washington. Thanks to Kim Lewis for booking our guests. Our engineer was Justin Thwaites. I'm Carol Castiel. Join me again next week for another Encounter on The Voice of America.